You may be thinking, I am tired of waking up in the dark. I need to see the sunrise again. But we have the clocks changed twice a year, and we already, as a nation, are struggling to get enough sleep. So we thought it was a good idea before daylight saving to have our sleep expert come on the show. Dr. Stephen Thaw is back, a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist with Hartford HealthCare's St. Vincent's Medical Center, and someone I have personally gone through to fix some of my sleeping habits. So Dr. Thaw, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, thank you very much. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on your show.
Of course. So first of all, Dr. Thaw, talk to us about the effects that the body goes through when the clocks change twice every year.
Right. So fortunately, this change works in our favor for the most part. We get an extra hour of sleep. So the that our society that's constantly sleep deprived, trying to work later, get more done, we really notice that 1 hour missing. If somebody's getting 6 hours of sleep, but then it becomes 5 hours of sleep if they lose the hour. Now, all of a sudden, we go from 6 hours of sleep potentially overnight to seven. So we're pretty good the week after this. The problem is when we change the clocks back, if we do change the clocks back come the springtime, that's when we run into trouble. Now, people would say, well, you know, we're used to it. Why not leave it this way? Well, there are real issues. If we continue to leave the clocks the way they are, it would be dark until, you know, 7:30 almost, maybe even 8 o'clock in the middle of the winter. So that would mean a lot of kids waiting on school buses in the dark, you know, people driving already tired, and then driving in the dark, making accidents more likely to occur. So there's something for switching us back from daylight savings time onto Eastern Standard Time. Then the debate comes, should we switch it, the clocks? Should we spring forward? Should we move the clocks ahead an extra hour come the springtime? Now, that is debatable, but one thing's for sure, we need to change the clocks back.
So that was going to be my question, Dr. Thaw. Then why not, once we move the clocks back, why not leave them? What happens for the rest of the year if we leave the clocks back where they are, once we move them this weekend?
It is a debate. There's a pro-con debate about whether or not it's worth it. You know, in an agricultural society, one would think it makes more sense. However, let's face it, we're not an agricultural society. And in fact, most of the places that, you know, don't hold most of the places in an agricultural society don't change the clocks. They just leave them where they are. Look, there are definitely advantages and disadvantages. The disadvantage mainly being that once you move the clocks forward, you should move them back in the winter. And then once you're moving them forward, you have to ask yourself, well, why are we doing this to ourselves? Maybe we should leave it. And that's a viable discussion. It's a pro-con debate. Some people would say it helps with, you know, heating costs. But, that doesn't seem,
I don't know, Dr. Thaw. I feel like, wasn't the whole reason for the clocks moving was because of farmers back in the day to make sure that they could do. So that's not really like a thing. Aren't there states that already have gotten rid of moving the clocks? Like, do we know if that's helped people with their sleep habits?
Well, I think, the issue that we have with society is that we are running sleep deprived. So anything we do with the clocks, we're already running very thin. Anything we do is just an extra detraction from our quality and quantity of sleep. So you can make the argument that way that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing it at all. Maybe we should be protecting our sleep a little bit more. But I would definitely err on the side of, you know, leaving, if you're going to leave it one way, let's move the clocks back an hour and keep it that way, as opposed to spring forward and leave it that way.
Okay. So we have Dr. Stephen Thaw here, a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist, and he's our sleep expert on the morning show. So, Dr. Thaw, whether or not people agree with it or not, it's happening. And so what are some things that with the clocks changing, because while this might be great for people, we're gaining an extra hour of sleep and we're going to wake up and the sun will be up earlier, we still will fall into bad habits. People are not getting enough sleep on average that they should be. We have screens constantly in our face that keeps people up. So what are some things that people should be doing to prepare themselves and to make sure that they are getting the necessary sleep that they should be each night?
Well, you know, one thing I should say, if you're a parent of a young child, they don't change the clocks back. So they're still waking up, you know, at the same time. So instead of them waking up at, you know, they'll still wake up, you know, early, even though we change the clocks. I would say that the advantage, again, is that we get to really focus our attention on getting the proper amount of sleep. In other words, to shut off our computer screens, shut off our phones, shut off the TV. Try to give yourselves a half an hour of quiet time to quiet the mind, to relax, and try to go to sleep with a clear head. And that way we don't expect our brains to behave like a light switch where we can just shut them off and turn them back on in the morning. It doesn't really work like that. There's a lot of processing that occurs as you go to sleep and in sleep, and all the day's events really do affect what happens and how you sleep and waking up in the middle of the night in a panic or in a terror. The other thing is, unfortunately, the news is horrible. Mm-hmm. The list of atrocities out there, you know, is just very upsetting. If you're watching the 11 o'clock news and expect to go to sleep right afterwards,
you're crazy. Well, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, especially, only a machine could do that. So you're asking for trouble. We should really just hesitate, even, you know, probably not even in this day and age when we can DVR or anything you want. I don't understand, you know, there's no reason to really stay up till midnight to watch something when you could watch it the next day at 6 or 7 p.m. the following night. I mean, mm-hmm. It just doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
So there are definite sleep issues, and that's the important thing, that when we switch the clocks is to reevaluate. It's almost like, you know, just the same way you check the smoke alarm. Well, you know, it's a good time. You know, you do it twice a year, and that way you know you're safe. So twice a year, reassess your sleep habits, reassess your sleep quantity and quality, and ask yourself, am I getting enough sleep? Do I need more sleep? What can I do to make my sleep better?
Dr. Stephen Thaw is here, a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist, and he's our sleep expert on the morning show. As the clocks roll back an hour this upcoming weekend, we want to make sure that we are taking care of ourselves, and that means our sleep. How important is getting enough sleep, Dr. Thaw? I don't think that's discussed enough in general.
You're right. It shouldn't be a secret that there's a reason why we sleep and how important it is. And we all need it. It's good for our brains. It's good for our bodies and every single organ, but especially the heart, the kidneys, the lungs, the pancreas. All these things require sleep in order to function properly. And when the human body doesn't sleep enough, or doesn't sleep well enough, so it's a quantity or quality issue. If you're short on the quantity or have poor quality sleep, the net effect is that things wear out faster.
Mm.
So it's an issue of having issues with your heart, whether it's heart rhythm disturbances, high blood pressure, heart attacks, heart failure. things like renal insufficiency, kidney issues, diabetes, you know, all these metabolic things that occur are because you're not allowing your body and your organs to have some downtime to do the things that happen during sleep, which is repair, heal, grow, renew. And without it, then things start wearing out. And people feel it when they wake up in the morning, maybe not the first few years, but slowly but surely it starts to accumulate.
Even weight loss sometimes is tied to if you don't get enough sleep.
Yes, it is. It's because of the metabolism, and also because potentially your pancreas is secreting more insulin on a regular basis, but you're also running on more adrenaline, which means that there's more sugar being broken down. So then the pancreas increases the insulin, and then it goes, and it's just like a cat chasing its tail. It's a vicious cycle in which things wear out faster. You're absolutely right. Weight loss is very much contingent upon your sleep. Lack of sleep will not only slow down your metabolism, in other words, you'll burn calories less efficiently, you also will be hungrier, and hungry at all the wrong times, so that, those 11:30 in the evening trips to the refrigerator for a pint of ice cream, all those things will occur when people don't sleep well. And then, of course, if you're tired, you'd rather not exercise. You just sit down on the couch and fall asleep. So you're burning fewer calories. You're burning calories less efficiently, and you're consuming more. It's the trifecta. So it really is. Imperative,
yeah,
if you want to lose weight, to get enough sleep.
Dr. Thaw, what about people who think if I caught up on sleep with a 2-hour nap that day, that's fine? So I got 6 hours of sleep last night, but I'm gonna nap for 2 hours today. For people who have that mentality, does that work?
Well, it can. The concern is if you take a 2-hour nap, how well will you be able to fall asleep that night? So for some people let's say you take the average talk show host that's up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Well, you might want to take a 2-hour nap just so that you can catch up. But the issue then becomes if you nap for too long, you're not going to be able to go to sleep at the right time. So there's reason to think that, a 20-minute nap or a 30-minute nap at the most is probably the sweet spot where you can feel like you've slept, like you're recharged, but it won't impair your ability to go to sleep the following night. Because again, if you go to sleep, let's say you take a 2-hour nap from 1 to 3, you're not going to be tired at 10 or 11. Or you may not be tired at 10. You might be tired at 12, but then you're already behind again. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to not just keep the nap time to no more than 30 minutes, but also to make sure that it's not so late that it impairs your ability to fall asleep later that night.
Do you have a recommendation for when people should get off screens? So let's say they go to bed at 9 o'clock at night. When should they be getting off of their screens to make sure they can fall asleep and wind down?
Right. Well, ideally it would be an hour before bedtime. But I would say at least a half hour. It all depends on how well you can fall asleep. If you can fall asleep easily after a half hour without the screens, that's fine. Some people could do it with just 15 minutes. That's fine, too. But there should be some time beforehand, especially if you're having trouble falling asleep, to shut off the screens, sit in a quiet room. You can read something relaxing. Better Home and Gardens, People Magazine, just to name a few I'm not promoting, but things that are not imperative, they're not work-related, there's no news, so you're not stressed about world events.
So maybe reading a book, for example, that's another thing
people read books. However, the problem with books is that they're designed for entertainment, and especially books, there's a plot, and you want to see what happens next. So some people keep going to finish the end of the book or to finish or get to a certain point. What you really want are short vignettes so that you can get to a, no matter where you are, you can stop, close it up, and pick up where you were before.
Mm,
if you take
point.
A travel magazine, let's say, Lake Cuomo will still be there tomorrow. Like, you don't have to finish the article, you know, today.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So that's
probably your better bet than doing like a book. Another thing, Dr.
Right.
Thaw, really quick, talk about remedies. Obviously, if you have a real issue, you can go to your doctor and they've got prescription medications for people who can't sleep. But for the everyday average person, what are things that you do recommend? I know it was you who told me that there still is not a lot of medical data out there to show the long-term effects of taking certain over-the-counter medications.
Like melatonin?
Like
is that
melatonin,
where you were going?
Correct.
Right. So, and again, I would admit that I'm not in the camp of pro versus con melatonin. I'm more in the con. I'm more against it because I don't think there's enough data, certainly in the dosages that are being used.
Mm-hmm.
They can't have long-term consequences, more so the younger you are. So the fact that a lot of young adults are starting to take it because it's over the counter, it's all natural, but it is, 10 million times stronger than what the body would ordinarily produce.
So what do you recommend instead?
Well, so I think the first thing is that you probably want to start making sure that your body's in the right cycle, trying to set. You can't always predict when you're going to fall asleep, but you can always predict. You can make sure you get up at around the same time every day. That helps anchor your biological clock to the morning time, so that a lot of people have the tendency, well, to sleep in on the weekend, but then it's like waking up in Los Angeles on Saturday morning. You're 3 hours off. And then when you try to go to sleep Sunday night, you're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
And then you set yourself up for
so staying consistent 7 days a week.
Yes.
That's interesting. Okay. What about tea before bed?
Well, it depends, right? So it depends which kind of tea. But yes, there are certain teas that people help them relax, whether it's actually medicinal, like something in those, that sleepy kinds
the sleepy
of
time tea.
Tea?
Sure.
I didn't want to name a name, give a brand name. But yes, there's something to that. Now, whether that's because of, the associations that it's rather than the medicinal effect, but does it really induce sleepiness or we associate it with sleepiness? In other words, we're trying to cue our body into relaxation. If that's all it takes, that's fine. Not a problem. But I think a routine is helpful to kind of turn the mind to a different station, to kind of change the channel a bit. Of course, never off of WICC, but nonetheless, we want to make sure that there's the wake daytime work time kind of mode, and before bedtime you start turning things down so that you are prepared to go to bed at night.
And again, I want to thank you so much for these tips, Dr. Stephen Thaw, pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist with Hartford HealthCare. And we always appreciate getting your help. You can always go to hartfordhealthcare.org/sleep if you want more information.
It's time for another Melissa in the Morning scam alert.
As you know, it was a horrific tragedy earlier this month in Maine where 18 people were killed, many others hurt, after a mass shooter opened fire in two businesses in Lewiston, Maine. And unfortunately, hate to be the bearer of bad news, but when tragedy strikes, that's when scammers come out of the woodwork. And so thank God for places like the Better Business Bureau making sure that if you're donating to support the victims in Maine, you're not being duped by a poser. And Kristen Johnson is back with us for the Better Business Bureau serving Connecticut to give us some tips to make sure we are not losing our money or giving it to the wrong hands. Hey, Kristen, how are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. Some really great information here from the BBB. Talk to us about what we should consider when it comes to crowdfunding requests.
Yeah, this is a little bit different than what we talked about recently with Israel and Hamas, because this is so local. It's happening in our country. It's happening in New England. So we're going to have a couple of different tips this morning. When it comes to crowdfunding, you just want to make sure that you're researching the source. A lot of different groups will pop up during times of tragedy, and they really prey on our emotions. So some crowdfunding sites will vet the people and make sure that the money is going to where they say it's going. Some don't. You just want to make sure you research that website, not just the charity, but the website that's being used as the third party. Find out whether they do screen first, what the transaction fees are, how much of your money actually will be going to the cause, that sort of thing.
What's an example of a crowdfunding site if people aren't familiar?
So you're catching me a little off guard, because as Better Business Bureau, we're not supposed to actually like promote one or over the other.
Okay.
So I don't really want to
push
people in one direction, but I will say there are some that are BBB accredited.
Okay.
And there are others that are not.
Okay.
So that's something to look for.
I don't mind. I'll do it myself then. Because I don't want to get you in trouble, Kristen. So GoFundMe is a great one, because I know I get questions about that all the time. GoFundMe is one of those where you have to be very careful. And we talk about it in the news. A lot of people will use it, and it has done a lot of great work for some, but it is also a perfect breeding ground for scammers. So just for people who have asked in the past, yes, GoFundMe would be like a crowdfunding source, just so that you know.
There you go.
Tell us, if you don't mind, Kristen, why does it matter about the respect to the families of the victims? Why is there a correlation between organizations and the families of the victims?
So when you go on those crowdfunding sites, a lot of times you will see pictures of the victims, and you will assume, because there are pictures of the victims, that that specific charity is connected with the family or that victim. But that's not necessarily the case. As we've talked about before, anyone can steal a picture off the internet. So unfortunately, you have to do more than just look up a charity and look to see if that picture is associated with the family. You actually need to find out whether they obtained permission from the family to not only use that photograph, but the names of the victims, which can be a little bit difficult, which is why we always say maybe skip the middleman and find a charity that that is helping, you know, directly with that family or with that tragedy, rather than going through a crowdfunding site.
Yeah, a good example of that is we saw that with Bristol a year ago after the tragedy of the two police officers. There were a lot of crowdfunding sites and, you know, selling T-shirts in honor of that, so on and so forth. But you never really knew if they were credible or not. And it was about a month later that the police department actually put out a couple of organizations that meant a lot to those officers and the family. And that was the best way to give back in honor of them, or to give back to support the families. So that's certainly something to look at as well. Is, you know, maybe give it a little bit of time to see what is actually what your dollars are going to go to, and are you really supporting the victims in the right way? We've got Kristen Johnson here of the Better Business Bureau giving us the heads up that, unfortunately, when you have tragedy strike, like we saw in Maine, that is the best time for scammers to take advantage of people and their vulnerabilities and to take your money. How do you verify, Kristen, that a charity is accountable?
So if you go to give.org, we actually have a list of 20 standards that we use when we accredit charities. Now, in this case, there's going to be a lot of charities that necessarily wouldn't already have been accredited, but you can use that as a guide as you're doing your own research and look for that information on their website. You just gave some really good advice. You know, Maine officials said in a press conference Friday that they are working on a list of charities, reputable charities, that they're going to recommend you donate to if you want to help. That list wasn't ready Friday. It should be coming out early this week. So look for that. And then once you have that list, then you can go down and look at the different standards that we use and figure out which one, you know, tugs at your heart the most, or which one you think would be the best, you know, for helping in the way that you want to see aid given to those families. But I think that using them as a resource, because obviously they are there in Maine and they know better than anyone who needs it and who's going to give the most help as quickly as possible. So look for those official notifications of charities.
Does it matter, Kristen, if donations are tax deductible?
So this is interesting. This is actually something I learned that we don't normally talk about when we're talking about, you know, like charities in a war zone or after a hurricane, is that in this case, because there were a certain number of victims, there's going to be some charities that pop up just for specific victims or specific victims' families. Those are not actually charitable donations that can be tax deductible. Now, that might not matter to you, but I think that when we always think about, oh, if I'm going to donate to charity, that's tax deductible. Well, actually, according to the IRS, contributions that are donor restricted that help a specific individual or a specific family are not tax deductible in the United States. You can go to the IRS's website for more specific information of why that is. But I think that was something important that I learned through my research on this.
I didn't know that. That is really good information. And I think another thing is we're talking about making sure that you're on a credible website, the description of the use of the donations, which again goes back to even your point of waiting for Maine to put that list together, because they're going to know better than any of us. But description matters.
Yeah, be careful of vague appeals. You want to ask questions. How is my money going to be used? They might say, oh, this will be collected for funeral expenses. But don't always assume that the money is going to go quickly to the person or the victim. You really need to do that research, ask those questions, and find out. Or donate to a charity that you know is present. For instance, I believe the American Red Cross is collecting blood donations. So if you don't have the money to give, perhaps you can give blood, and that will help. So there's always different ways that we can give beyond the financial. But again, you definitely want to be leery of organizations or groups that pop up that you've never heard of before, because they can be more difficult to research. But whoever it is, just ask the questions. And if you get a social media request that says, you know, click to donate, don't be so quick to donate. Make sure they're trustworthy, because at the end of the day, you want your money going to help those victims and their families.
Mm-hmm. And again, don't forget that resource that the Better Business Bureau has given to you, which is going to give.org, the website give.org. You can verify if the charity meets the 20 BBB standards for charity accountability. So make sure you use that website, certainly, and wait for Maine as well to give you that list, which they're going to make public hopefully later on this week. And Kristen, thank you so much for getting this information out there. It's always so important that we're on top of what scammers are doing and to better protect ourselves. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. And if you see something that doesn't seem trustworthy, please report it to BBB Scam Tracker at bbb.org/scam tracker. That way we can look into it and find out if it is a scam, let the authorities know, and let our community know, so their money isn't winding up in the hands of a scammer.
Yeah, good point. Definitely don't keep that information to yourselves. Make sure you report it to bbb.org/scam tracker. Kristen Johnson, always appreciate you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Have a great rest of your morning.
Thank you. You too. What is wrongful termination? According to an attorney based in Florida, about 90% of people actually don't define it correctly. So let's talk about that and hostile work environments. We've got Gary Phelan back on the show with us, our employment attorney on WICC. Gary, welcome. How are you?
Good, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. First of all, Gary, what brought your attention to that finding and discussing wrongful discharge?
Based on the number of calls I get and our firm gets, you know, on a daily basis, those two terms are things that I think most people aren't familiar with it, just because we hear it. And then when they explain what happened, it clearly doesn't fit within a legal the legal meanings of those terms. It's more like focused on things like fairness. And so I think it's important to know what it isn't before talking about what it is.
Okay, so let's start with that. What is wrongful termination?
Well, it's where the if somebody has been terminated, if they believe it's due to their race, due to their age, religion, gender, sexual orientation, if it's something based on a, you know, legally protected category, then it might be a wrongful termination. Or if it's retaliation for having complained about what they believe was wrongful conduct, or if it's a whistleblower. What it's not, and that's why most people assume that it's, for example, where an employer doesn't give a reason for termination, the employee believes that they were performing well, that the employer's reason was false or that it was unfair or they hadn't been given prior warnings. Those are things that it may be wrong in a layperson's sense, but it doesn't make it a legal claim unless it's one of the more of the protected categories, or if they have a contract, for example, that says they can't be terminated except for just cause, then that might be something that would be a breach of contract claim. But I think it is important that people know not only what it is but what it isn't.
Yeah, I have to be honest though, Gary, it's kind of confusing. Like what you just said, well, does sound a lot like a fairness issue. Like that's hard to define.
Well, it's in a sense it's not about fairness. It's the distinction really is what's fair and what's illegal. And I say that to somebody calling in at least once a day. And because if something is illegal, it means it's something where the law says you can't terminate someone based on race, based on age, based on religion. Those are specific prohibitions in the law. There is nothing in the law that says beyond that, those protected categories or whistleblowers, that you can't terminate an employee. Most employees are what's called, the terminology is an at-will employee, which means somebody is at will, just like the employee can choose to resign, that the employer can terminate the individual for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all. And so the fact that it may be extremely unfair, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's illegal.
Interesting. So we have Gary Fallon here. And if you're like me and you don't know the law as well as clearly as Gary Fallon does, you might be misconstruing what exactly wrongful termination is. And that's why it sounds like you're getting a lot of calls on this, Gary, is because many times people will think that they were wrongfully terminated when in fact it was a judgment call. So what do you do in that regard, Gary? If you have somebody who's calling and saying, I was just fired for this, and you're like, ooh, it doesn't really fall under the wrongful termination category, is there anything you can legally do, or do you have to just kind of suck it up and move on?
Well, one is just to kind of explore, was it due to one of those protected categories?
Okay.
So let's say that, let's take the example of the individual says the reason was false. That the employer gave me, I'll ask, well, what do you believe was the reason? And then if the employee says, I believe it was my age, and then describes, that they had a great history, a strong performance background, new supervisor came in, a younger person who all of a sudden is terminating people who are older. Well, then that may be that age is a factor, was the real reason for the termination. So that's one thing. But second thing is also, is sometimes people may talk to the employer about perhaps negotiating a severance, asking for, some sort of assistance, maybe if the employer will agree not to challenge a claim for unemployment. But most of the time, there's no legal claims. I think there is sort of this pervasive belief that if somebody believes, again, it's wrong in the personal sense, that there's got to be a legal remedy. The overwhelming majority of terminations, there is not a legal remedy.
So Gary Fallon is an employment attorney for Mitchell and Sheehan, the Mitchell and Sheehan Law Firm, but he also is a Quinnipiac Law School. You teach law there. You're an adjunct professor there, right, Gary?
Correct. I teach employment law courses as well as alternative dispute resolution courses.
So something that we talk a lot about with one of our employment experts on the show, Julie Bauke, she's a career strategist. We talk about hostile work environments, and especially for the younger generation going into the working world for the first time, a lot of them. What do you tell your college students? What do you tell them about hostile work environments? Because that plays hand in hand sometimes with either wrongful termination or unfairness in the workplace.
Well, once again, it's what does it mean to a layperson? What does it mean legally? to a layperson, often based on the calls we get, it's where, you know, they're in, you know, a toxic work environment where people are bullying, where they're mean, where their supervisor, you know, is just a miserable human being and sort of takes it out on them. And that's all, you know, that's obviously not good to be working in a work environment like that. But once again, it's not a legal claim. You know, where you have what is often phrased as a, you know, a bully boss, that's not illegal. In order for a hostile work environment to state some sort of legal claim, it has to be based on the, you know, the treatment has to be based on one of those protected categories. The most common example is sexual harassment in the workplace, or if it's targeting older workers or workers based on their race or national origin. That, from a legal standpoint, may be a hostile work environment. I always encourage people to try to resolve it internally if they can. And if they can't, and there really is just a, you know, a bullying boss or something of that nature, think about leaving, you know, because who wants to work in an environment like that?
Gary Fallon is an employment attorney with Mitchell & Sheehan. He also is an adjunct professor for the Quinnipiac Law School. And we're talking about things like wrongful termination, hostile work environments. I wanted to know, Gary, when is someone entitled to unemployment benefits?
If the person is terminated for any reason other than some sort of wrongful conduct, they're entitled to unemployment benefits. The most common example is where an employer says they're terminating someone for poor performance. That individual should still be able to get unemployment from the state of Connecticut.
Okay, now here's the other side of it, though, Gary, because I know Mitchell & Sheehan doesn't just represent the employees. It'll represent employers as well. What do you suggest for employers to avoid, obviously, a wrongful termination lawsuit or creating hostile work environments that can lead to those lawsuits? What do you tell an employer that has to decide or has decided already to terminate an employee?
Well, first, to make sure it's the right decision, because, you know, one of the things from a business standpoint, turnover costs money. So the first thing is to really think about, is this, can this, you know, working relationship be salvaged? Does this person have potential? Let's assume you have already gone through that and you conclude the reason is, you know, that they can't and you want to terminate. First is the giver reason. You don't have to. But you should, because what happens is if the employer just says, I'm not going to tell you, employees will often substitute, you know, what they believe. And that's one of the main reasons, I think, that prompts people to go to, you know, to an attorney or pursue legal claims. Secondly, even when doing it, do it with compassion and empathy. This is going to be an important, sometimes traumatic event for the individual. And you know, recognize that in advance. Person may vent, be angry. Don't get into a debate where you feel like you have to justify the termination. The objective is to really inform the employee and then get things like, you know, their laptop or their company keys, but kind of accept the fact that it's, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable. Perhaps consider paying some sort of severance in exchange for a waiver of legal claims. The employer might want to also consider if it's something based on performance, for example, is not telling the person they will not challenge any claim for unemployment benefits. And, you know, also because, you know, sometimes the people we counsel feel bad about it, you know, is that, you know, you're running a business. And if this is becoming a drain on the business, you need to make a decision, just like you make other business related decisions. And also, you know, this may be not in the short term, but in the long term, good for that employee, because if the person wasn't performing the job, it may be they have talents that are suited for another job. This just doesn't have to be a good fit.
Here's another thing, Gary. Is it ever a good idea for the employer to give an employee the heads up? Like your performance, let's say this person works in sales. You know what, we've had you here, and for the last 3 months, your numbers are just not where we want them to be. We're going to give you X amount of time, and if we don't see something, we're going to have to terminate you. Is that ever a good idea to give people the heads up, be very transparent, or could that lead to more lawsuits the more open you are with people?
Generally speaking, it is a good idea just because the person may turn their performance around. It gives them a warning. That's something that people call and feel like it, you know, they weren't aware. Why didn't the employer tell them? So from the standpoint of communication, I think it's definitely a good idea.
What about if there are layoffs? You know, like what if you have, you know, a bunch of people from the same department laid off at the same time? Does the employer have to do anything in that regard? Like, what if it's because the company lost a lot of money? That I would think that can't be considered wrongful termination, or maybe it could. I don't know.
Well, no. Generally speaking, that again is a business related reason. There may be claims with not providing them warning, which, you know, there's a statute called WARN. If they have more than 50 employees and there's a layoff, they have to give advance notice. This segment's too short to go through the complexities of the WARN statute, but, generally giving people advance warning is a good idea. What is always a risk is the employee is going to then be spending their time looking for another job on the company, time.
Yeah.
But I think it's a risk worth taking.
That's true. Right. There's always two sides to every story. And we know Gary Phelan, who is an employment attorney at Mitchell & Sheehan. He actually covers both sides, representing both employers and employees, and also speaking about that as an adjunct professor for Quinnipiac Law School. And I thank you so much, Gary, for sharing your insight right here on WICC as often as you do. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, Gary Phelan here on WICC.
In a recent Forbes Advisor report, it was looking at the most common reasons for divorce. In 2023, do you want to know what the top two were? Interestingly enough, number one, lack of commitment. In fact, 75% of individuals and couples cited lack of commitment is the number one reason that they got divorced. Number two, 60% of divorced couples cited infidelity. You want to know one of the commonalities between the two of those? Probably selfishness. What's best for me? Self-centered. I'm worried about myself, not us, but me, myself, and I. And so we wanted to talk about the difference between being selfless and selfish and why it impacts a marriage so greatly. And joining us for that is our marriage coach, Bob Donovan, is back. Hey, Bob, how are you?
I'm good. Good. Good morning to you. Great topic, huh?
I mean, it's pretty telling, and I know you and I have talked about it, actually, in some of our past segments, because I find that it really is such an important key to making a marriage work. And so I'm glad that we're going to highlight this. Talk to us, if you don't mind, first of all, about the difference between the two, if you could define it for us.
Yeah. So this came up a few weeks ago, and it, got me thinking, and it was an interesting topic, and I started digging into it a little bit. And, the more I got into it and thought about it, the more complicated it got. Because you really kind of need both, right? I mean, you can't be a doormat. You can't just totally, I'm not important, but you can't go to the other extreme, too. So, I started digging into this and understanding, what's required. So in some ways, neither is good, right? Neither is good. But in some ways, both are good at times. So that's what I came up with, and we can unpack this a little bit.
Can I just rebut though, if you don't mind, real fast?
Of course, you could.
So I totally agree with you that both can be good at times. However, I will say, if both spouses are selfless, you don't have to be selfish. And what I mean by that is if you're both committed to being selfless. So, for example, self-care is not something that is my forte. I've never been very good at it. However, thank God I have a very selfless husband because he forces me to do things that are really great for me. And then when I'm done with that really great thing, I'm like, oh, thank God you're watching out for me because I would not do it. So, for example, getting deep tissue massages once a month, that's really good for me. It's literally good for my body. It makes me a better version of myself. That's only because my husband puts it in our budget, forces me to go, makes it a thing. So I will argue if both of you are really great at being selfless, nobody really has to be selfish.
And here's in theory, you're right. And that's actually one of my conclusions, right, that you both kind of need to be selfless. But in reality, that's not reality because circumstances change.
True.
If your tank is low, you're certainly not going to be in ability to give yourself, to give love, to receive love. So
I see what you're saying. Okay.
You see,
yes,
so
that's a different
you know,
thing.
Like,
yes. Okay.
Yeah, you have to really dig into this a little bit. And
well, thank God you did, because clearly I did not.
Yeah, because you're right, again, in theory, but, you know, I mean, I remember, like, we've gone 48 years. We've gone through seasons where, I know what my wife has said, when her mother was going through some tough times, she just said, I'm not going to be at my best. That's code for I really can't give much of myself.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and that's life. That's life. Like, if you're in a season in work, which is insane and crazy, and you're working 70 hours a week, like Derek, he's in that now, right?
Yeah, he's in open enrollment. But I guess I don't
exactly like
that word then. Maybe it's just that I don't like that word. Like, when Derek says to me, I can't give you what you need, Melissa, or I need you to do more with the house because I can't be home, I don't see that as him being selfish. I see that as that just means I've got to do more. To make it work for him.
You
know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like he's like, hey, I need you to do more at the house because I want to go out and drink with the guys. Like, that is selfish. You know what I'm saying?
Correct.
I just don't like
that.
Yeah,
exactly
word.
Right. And actually, you know, when you really think about this, that's kind of where I end up, that neither one of these terms are good.
Okay.
Neither one of these terms are good. Because just think about that narrative. Like, I need to be a little selfish right now, even though that's true, because if I'm depleted and I'm exhausted and I'm tired, I really do need to be selfless. But really, it really means it's code for I need to take care of myself.
Right.
And maybe
sounds like self-care.
Maybe I'm not able to.
Yeah. I don't know. That's I don't know. Yeah. So, okay, cool. I'm glad that we agree on that, because maybe it's just the word that ticks me off. I just don't
totally
like that
right.
word. Yeah.
It's totally right. And actually, I don't like either word. Okay.
Right, because selfless makes you sound like a doormat. I agree with that, too.
Exactly
yeah,
right.
I don't
exactly
like that.
Right. So that's where I think when you peel back the onion here, you go layer by layer, understanding what these really mean. And even if you understand what they mean, just think about that conversation. You know, I need to be a little selfish right now regarding my needs. Well, you know what? I don't care how I say that. That's just not good language. That's not a good tone. That's not a good message. So,
no,
so you have to be careful with those words.
I agree.
You are. Ugh. However, right, the essence of that is that there are times when you need to, I can't give up more than I give to you.
Mm-hmm.
I need to take care of myself. And I think, and there's seasons to this. So it is complicated. And when you come into marriage, like, think about it. You basically are independent, self-sufficient for whatever, 20, 25, 30 years. And then you flip the switch. And now somebody else is more important than you. So right away, you're coming in at a little disadvantage.
Right,
and
because
you know
what's funny? you've set a tone with yourself for your entire life that all
right?
you have to worry about
of
is yourself.
You
and then all of a sudden it changes 25, 30 years later. That's true. That's a real
exactly.
slap in the face.
And for those
wow.
of us, like, I think Derek's the only child, correct?
Yes, he is.
So am I.
Oh,
so
I
that,
know.
That
you two with your bestie
hyper.
Garbage going on. I know. You two. You're so alike.
Right?
I'm always like, oh, here we go.
I wish that just is what it is. But so, you know, so your upbringing, you're driven to be independent, self-sufficient, mm-hmm. and you flip this. Then think about it. You stand in front of a justice of peace or a pastor or a priest, and you make these words, right, that you promise to love, cherish, care for somebody else, right, regardless of finances,
right.
sickness, and health,
yeah.
for the rest of your. So you're saying, I'm going to take care of you, make your needs more important than me for the rest of my life. So just think about you're independent, self-sufficient, and then boom, you're not. It doesn't work that way.
Right. It just can't. It's not a switch that you could just turn on and off.
It's not.
And actually,
not.
I think we should do a deep dive kind of talking about just clarifying and breaking down selfish versus selfless into four parts. And that'll be, you know, one of the aspects of it is what does a marriage require? Also, the difference between the two spouses and what is best. We're talking about being selfish versus selfless in a marriage. However, those words can be kind of misleading. So we want to clarify that with our marriage coach, Bob Donovan. Let's break this down into four parts, Bob, starting with what does marriage require?
Yeah, well, I think again, going back to the wedding vows that every couple works so hard to write, that it really means putting the needs of your spouse ahead of your own. That's really, I can take every vow, and I looked at a bunch. In essence, that's what it is, that I promise to love you unconditionally, sacrificially, to place your need ahead of my own. That's really what it requires. A selfish spouse can't do that, because a selfish spouse, in the end, is all about me, myself, and I. It's about getting my needs met for the end game of me, you see? So it's the vows really represent a heart of a selfless spouse to be committed towards the well-being and care of their spouse. That's really what it means. And so let me give you a just real practical example of a selfish spouse, right? And typically this happens a lot. Like whether two couples work or one works, doesn't really matter, but they come home at night and one is just whipped. They're tired. Okay. Mm. A selfish spouse is totally focused on, I'm tired. I need to have some downtime. I need to re-energize. I need to do this, this, and this. Even if their spouse is in a whole different place or, I need to talk to you about X, a selfish spouse can't because they're focused on what they need right now. A selfless spouse comes in the home, even though they're tired and whatever, it's a working mom or dad, doesn't really matter, right? Says to the spouse, I'm really beat, but I see you're a little stressed right now. How was your day? And you'd basically, you turn it around, flip the switch. You're able to put yourself on the back burner and be attentive to your spouse. Mm. That's a practical example of a selfish spouse and a selfless spouse. A selfless spouse is able to put their needs on the back burner and be present, even though they're tired, even though they don't feel like it, but listen to their spouse when they need to. That's a really good example.
But obviously both of those can be extremes, Bob. You can have somebody who, if you're very selfish, you just really don't care unless it's convenient to you. So when you come home and you're not stressed out or you have nothing going on, well, then I can give you my time. You're like a last priority over yourself. But with a selfless person, you could bury and bury and bury stuff that's going on with you, and that could lead to health issues. That could lead to resentment for your spouse. That could lead to really a divorce, because you've talked about that on this show before, where people are like, you know what? I just don't love this person anymore. And, and it's like, well, where did that come from? And you look back and you're like, actually, for the last 5 years, you haven't cared at all about anything I'm going through. So they're both are really can be very extreme if that's the way you're going about it, which is why you kind of have to find a balance, it sounds like. So what is the best thing to be?
So I think, first of all, you and I kind of talked about it a little bit, right? Neither one of us like these terms. I mean, I really don't, because both to the extreme really aren't for the benefit of the marriage. But so what I like to talk about and really understand is changing it from selfish and selfless to each spouse needs to have a healthy and accurate self-view.
They need to value
themselves. You know, it's interesting in the Jesus's greatest commandment of love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor
as yourself.
You remember? Mm-hmm. As yourself. You ever think about that? That God wants us to love our neighbors like we love ourselves. So having an accurate, healthy view of yourself, to be able to receive love and give love, to be able to pay attention to your own well-being. Why? So that you can give to your spouse. That if you need a deep tissue massage once a month, or you need to go on a walk 3 or 4 times a week, that you can be. You see what I'm saying? It's the end result of a selfless spouse, of a selfish spouse. It's all about, I need this for me.
It's being like a self-aware spouse. It sounds like self-aware.
Yeah. And that's another term that a selfish spouse is often horribly unself-aware.
Mm.
Horribly.
Yeah.
Like they have no impact. They have no view on how their behavior impacts their spouse. None. And another good example, I like to give practical examples, like a common conversation a lot of couples have, we have it a couple times a year, is when one of us, often it's my wife, says, you know what, I'm just not feeling like a priority right now. And that was us this summer, because our son was busy, crazy, I was real busy, and Karen said that, right? Now, a selfless spouse gets defensive, right? A selfish spouse says, hey, I'm doing these things. I'm going to work. I'm providing this home. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Like, how do you say that? We went on a date a month ago. Like, that's a selfish spouse. A selfless is able to put all that behind them and says, tell me more about that.
Mm.
Right? Understand.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They can turn off the switch and focus on their spouse and their needs. Not even if what's going on in them, that's me, you know, I get my natural instinct is get defensive, but
right,
I can switch
right
that off most times. Most
well, we're
times
not perfect. We're flawed, right? We're all flawed.
Right.
So that's okay, Bob. Don't
right
worry.
Right.
Honesty is
right
great. It's true.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's
so
good.
You know, another good example of, you know, it's the end goal of taking care of yourself is that so you can be at your best to give, to love, as you said in your wedding vows, sacrificially and unconditionally to your spouse. That's really the big difference, is to have a healthy and accurate self-view so that you can put yourself in a healthy place to give and receive love to your spouse, put their needs, their concerns ahead of your own. That's really what this is all about.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, Bob, it sounds great, right? It sounds great on paper, and I think it makes sense logically. But sometimes you have to do a lot of hard wiring and fixing things within yourself to also recognize that maybe this is a problem in your own marriage. So if people wanted to reach out to you to get just basic coaching, and maybe it would lead to, hey, you know what, you need like a therapist for this. But if they wanted to start by just talking to you and getting your perspective, what is the best way to reach you?
Yeah. You know, it's funny that I just actually met with a guy on Saturday morning and this was exactly the topic. He was depleted. And I basically said, you need to really like be more focused on yourself and take care of yourself so you can be at your best in your marriage. Mm-hmm. Like that was exactly the conversation.
Interesting.
So anyway, yep. Love to talk to anybody that's interested in this. Best would be an email at bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blackrock.org.
Bob, always love getting your perspective on these things. And thank you for the work that you do and for sharing it here on WICC. I appreciate it.
All right, Melissa, take care now.
Thank you. You too. Bob Donovan, our marriage coach, right here on Melissa in the Morning.